This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. This week's episode was recorded on February 28th, 2016. On this week's episode, Tia Vasiliou, Paul Jaisley, and our host, Mike Rappin, discuss comic book storage and care. And Tia schools us on why we're all doing it wrong, at least if your goal is to preserve your comics for generations to come. They also discuss their preferred organizational methods for their books. By publisher? Alphabetically? Autobiographically? Learn how to crank your comic storage up to 11 on this episode, which starts now.
This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I am your host, Mike Rappin, editor-in-chief for Destroy the Cyborg. With me this week are two fantastic human beings, Tia Vasiliou.
Hello.
And Paul Jaisley.
Hello.
How are you guys doing this week? How have comic books been for you?
Comics have been weird, Mike. At least the ones I read this week.
Weird.
Were very weird. So among the books I read this week, the weirdest among them were Dark Knight 3, The Master Race number 3.
Oh, man.
It was a fine issue. I feel like it was kind of the exposition issue, you know, leading up to the big action down the road. But I really liked the mini comic this month. About the Green Lantern, Hal Jordan, with art by Frank Miller and John Romita Jr.
Oh.
It looked lovely. I thought it was one of the best looking things that either of those guys have done in a long time. So, recommended for that
alone. I haven't cracked my copy yet.
I really enjoyed that. That's probably my favorite part so far. I've liked the mini comics more than the actual issues so far already, but there's a good example of that.
I felt the exact same way.
Well, there's less commitment with those.
Yeah, exactly. And you kind of expect them to be weird anyway, so it's not...
Yeah.
Art Ops number 5. Again, I'm really enjoying this series. I think after the last issue, I had tweeted that it reminded me of Doom Patrol, the Grant Morrison run on Doom Patrol, and this was the perfect example of that. I thought this issue was this mix of high concept and just absurd slapstick humor, you know, at the same time. Perfect.
Mm-hmm.
My cup of tea, exactly. And then... Transformers vs. G.I. Joe number 11. This issue was awesome, as every issue of this series has been. This issue, I mean, we praise this book because of Tom Scioli's amazing off-the-wall artwork, but it's easy to overlook the risks that him and John Barber take with the storytelling. I mean, this issue starts with a big action sequence and then jumps to a flashback, and then there's a flashback in the flashback.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't feel weird or forced at all. It completely makes sense. Just a fantastic storytelling device. Great issue. I can't come up with more words to explain how much I love this series. But oddly enough, Transformers vs. G.I. Joe was not the weirdest comic I read this week. Because I bought and read The Coming of the Supermen number 1, written and drawn by Neil Adams. This book was bonkers.
What is the... I've never heard of this before.
Okay, so... A couple years ago, Neil Adams did a Batman series called Batman Odyssey. It was like a 12-issue miniseries, and it's the weirdest Batman comic that's ever been published. It involved dinosaurs living under the earth, under the Batcave. It was just the weirdest comic imaginable. Mm-hmm. But DC, I mean, obviously Neil Adams is such a legend. DC's willing to just give him 6 to 12 issues to do whatever the fuck he wants. And so this is his version of Superman doing the same thing.
So as someone who doesn't... I mean, I know the name Neil Adams, but could you give us some history really quick? Because maybe some of our listeners don't really know who he is.
Well,
I mean, I don't know who he is. I'll be honest. Let's go with that.
I mean, so Neil Adams, he started drawing comics in the late 60s. He did pretty famous runs on Batman and Green Lantern, Green Arrow. He worked on the X-Men early on.
Okay.
I guess in terms of importance, as far as artwork goes, he's second only to Jack Kirby. I mean, he... basically changed the way superhero comics are drawn forever.
I see.
Doing the super realistic anatomy, very detailed, you know, big, bold splash pages and stuff. An amazing, amazing talent who is of a generation that, you know, doesn't really... Maybe his work now that he does has no bearing on contemporary comic book storytelling at all. And it's kind of fascinating because of that. So this issue, Coming of the Superman number 1, is, you know, you have 3 Supermen show up. They have Superman's outfit on. They have his powers, but they're not sure how to use them. Then all of a sudden, parademons from the planet Apocalypse show up, and they start fighting over Metropolis. Then Superman, who happens to be in Egypt at the time, gets word of this and goes to join them, but doesn't reveal himself to those Supermen because he's kind of nervous about how they're going to react.
What?
Meanwhile, we find out that Darkseid's father was one of the ancient gods in Egypt, and he's who the Sphinx is designed after. This book makes no absolute sense, and I love it because of that. And because because it has Darkseid and Kalibak and all these new gods characters, Neil Adams is sort of channeling Jack Kirby on a lot of the artwork. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, Jack Kirby, 70s Jack Kirby comics are my favorite thing ever. So to see Neil Adams sort of do that, it was a hell of a lot of fun. I couldn't make heads or tails of the story, but God help me if I'm not going to buy the rest of it because of that. So...
Sometimes we just need a little weird in our superhero books, right?
Exactly, exactly.
That's fantastic. Tia, how have comics been for you?
Oh, it's been a pretty good week. I feel like all of the things that I read were just super beautiful. So A-plus artists who've been working their little fingers to the bone for us, maybe to continue the discussion about artists. My favorite thing that I read this week was Hellboy and the BPRD 1953. And, you know, I always forget how much I like Hellboy. I always see Hellboy and I'm like, oh, I love Hellboy. I need to read more Hellboy. I even have a note in my phone that says, like, read these Hellboy books. And I just always forget. I always forget to, or I'll go to look it up and I'll just remember how much Hellboy and BPRD stuff there is that I have to catch up on, and I just am like, no, I can't do it.
It's so overwhelming sometimes. Like, you're like, I want to read a lot of Hellboy, and then you're like, oh, I don't know if
so
I can read that much Hellboy.
The great thing about the Hellboy and the BPRD is that there was a 1952 series, and so now we're into 1953, and these things are sort of chronicling Hellboy's early years with the Bureau. So all of that stuff hasn't happened yet. So you don't need to know about it, really. And they're, the 1953 ones are just kind of these like monster of the week little vignettes, you know, so it's kind of a nice way to sort of come down from the new X-Files, maybe, you know, just sort of weird, cool, supernaturally stories and the characters who you like and their interactions, but without the responsibility of having to be like, wait, what was that again? Who's that? What's happening? And I really loved this one. This short was called Beyond the Fences. And Hellboy and Stegner and Susan Chang have to go to California to investigate this series of missing children because there's a lot of weird stuff that put it on their radar. And when they get there, Sue and Stegner are really concerned with this wacky scientist, and they get this like rock from him, and it makes Sue see monsters. So they're all about these monsters, and like there's a body that was all mangled, so definitely monsters. And and Hellboy, you know, he just like he notices a little kid crying and he goes and talks to him. The kid's like, I lost my dog. And Hellboy, like, you know, comforts him. And then, you know, he notices some lady say, like, well, if you're here, you know, my cat's been missing for a week. And he's like looking around and he's thinking, why are there no birds in this neighborhood? So,
Hellboy pet detective, essentially.
but, you know, I feel like as a unique character on a team of unique investigators, I think it's really nice that Hellboy isn't just the muscle or the weird supernatural demon expert. Like he he is noticing things that everyone else isn't noticing because they're too busy with the monsters. And that's just a nice way, I think, to construe Hellboy, especially the way that they physically frame him in the panels. The coat, like the Stegner wears like a trench coat and it's brown and it kind of just makes him fade into the landscape of Southern California, which is that great kind of desaturated palette, you know, but and then all of the people in the neighborhood are wearing these brightly colored outfits that kind of, when you just look at the artwork and there's Hellboy and he's bright red and there's these people and they're in bright colors and everyone else is just kind of, you know, neutral toned, and it really drives home you know, Hellboy's connection to these people and that he's really listening to them. So, and then there were some other cool moments when they were looking around at nighttime and Hellboy's like being haloed by these streetlights. And it was just a really nice way for the art to push the story without being narrative. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, I think we've had that. We've talked about that 100 times on this show. You know, just that ability to tell the story without actually seeing it in print, like in word format, you know?
Yeah.
Actually, but even, like, giving the emotion through color and through, like, panel layout.
Yeah, yeah. Because even these details, they're not exactly, like, a story point. Like, Hellboy is brightly colored, like this lady's dress. That's not exactly a story point, but it just kind of, you almost subconsciously just sort of associate Hellboy with these people because you're visually making that connection through the color. I thought it was really beautiful. I also read, and I'm so happy, and can you all please just read Journey into Mystery so you can be happy with me already, the conclusion to the first arc of Angela, Queen of Hell. So Angela and Sarah, they are the Marvel OTP, they are beautiful together. They get to have all kinds of great on-screen romance. And Stephanie Hans, I swear to God, the woman is a wizard. I don't know how she does it. She made the most beautiful page. It's just this like pinup of Sarah and Angela kissing with this like beautiful swirls and stars all around them. It's just the most ennobling romantic thing. And I love that Marvel's like going there for this lesbian couple. And it's not in a sexy sort of like male gazy way. It's like just really beautiful and romantic. And so I'm just so thrilled about that. And also
slapping that Batwoman thing right in the face. Just saying, hey, you want to see two women get together? We'll do it. This is Marvel Comics.
We'll do it and it will be beautiful.
Yeah.
And then there's Thori Death Ripper, who's one of my favorites from Journey into Mystery. And there's this great scene where Angela's sitting in the throne of hell and Sarah's sitting on the arm of the throne and she's holding Thori like a baby. And I just want to die. It's so cute. You know,
this is the hellhound, right?
This is the hellhound. He's very naughty. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this whole book has been really, I don't know, it almost reminds me of Deadpool in that it kind of breaks the fourth wall a lot. Sarah is a really great narrator, and I wonder if you dug into that a little bit, if there would be a useful comparison to be made. I don't know what it is yet. This is just occurring to me, but I thought it was interesting. Mm-hmm. Marguerite Bennett's doing some really interesting things with the way she presents the narrative and using, you know, almost kind of poking fun at herself when things get a little exposition-y, and it's very, very charming read.
Awesome.
Yes.
I'm gonna skip your last pick just because I don't know anything else about Lucifer and I really need to read that book.
You do.
And I don't want anything spoiled.
There was peen. That's all I'll say. And I was so happy.
Okay.
Thank you, Lee Garbett.
Well, this week I sat down. I didn't have a lot of time to read comics for some reason this week. I like was out of it. Half sick, half just exhausted from life. But I did manage to sit down and read a couple comics last night and this morning. I read Fresh Romance number 7, and I'm so happy that that book is finally back. And I was really worried that we weren't going to see anything after issue number 6. But lo and behold, here we are. I'm so excited. I also read Rick and Morty 8 through 10. I managed to snag those when they went on sale for $1.99 each, and that book continues to be just wild and obnoxious, and I love it. And I read Cry Havoc number 2, which the more and more I think about Cry Havoc number 2, I like am in love with the way that they're telling the story, specifically all of the scenes in Afghanistan and Simon Spurrier's way of describing chaos in like the metaphor that represents for on like multiple layers in that book. It's too good. And of course Ryan Kelly's art or like pencils are fantastic. I was really like, there were parts of this issue in specific where I was really thinking like, this isn't the Ryan Kelly art that I'm used to, in a really good way. Like, I'm used to Ryan Kelly's art, like, I don't know, all I can think of is New York 4, New York 5, and Local, and how a lot of the characters all kind of blend and look the same, and like all of the women are kind of drawn in the same proportions and the same style, but this book is totally different, and I'm absolutely loving it. Like, this guy has seriously kicked his work up a notch, and into that point, like the coloring work, as we've said many, many times before about issue number one, has been great, and I'm definitely feeling the different vibes from each of the different colorists based on the different perspectives and timelines and stuff like that, so that's really good. This book is fantastic. I cannot explain how excited I am for the rest of the series.
It's so neat to see art really pushing comics forward.
Yeah, like this, it seems like we all enjoyed something about art this week. I mean, who'd have thought? But even still, like, we've had some great, great comics this week. But yeah, Karnak number two is actually my big, what did I read this week? I've been waiting for this book, and this was my pick last week. This was a fantastic, action-packed, smart-ass issue, and there were some really strange choices made about how they told, like, this issue story of Karnak breaking into this terrorist organization. I keep calling it a terrorist organization. It's like a cult, but it's either way. It's of like Karnak growing up and being this weird child who should have been an Inhuman King, but instead did not take the Terrigen Mist. And I didn't know that happened with that character. So they did all this stuff with him as a baby, and they kept flashing back to him as an adult infiltrating and fighting people, but then they'd cut back to this baby making the same action poses. And so it was really, I don't know, it was really bizarre. But the issue on the whole was really good. It's diving deeper into Karnak's backstory, which I'm really liking, like, way more than I thought I would. Mm-hmm. And this is a very drastic change from issue one, where it felt like there was just a lot of smart-ass comments, and instead it's, like, a lot of introspective about Karnak as a character as he's solving this mystery about who this cult is and where this missing child went in the story. So, yeah, it's really exciting. Did either of you happen to read this book?
I did not.
No, you know my complete ambivalence toward Warren Ellis. And yeah, oddly enough, the Inhumans are like characters I want to really like read and know more about because they seem like such a uniquely Jack Kirby creation, but they never seem to be done in a way that's interesting to me. I don't know if that's something inherent to the characters themselves. Even Jack Kirby kind of like gave up on them. Like, he didn't do very much stuff with them, so.
No, I actually felt the same way about a lot of the Inhuman stuff, and I really wanted to like them. And this is the one book that I'm actually trying. It happens, you know, to be a Warren Ellis book because, you know, I'm biased, but I figured if I'm going to like the Inhumans in any way, it's probably going to be written, you know, by this guy.
Sure.
And Gerardo Zaffino, that's his name. His art has been just killer. It's way rougher in this most recent issue, but in a good way. Like, all of the action is very, like, it's very action-y drawn. Like, there's no steadiness. There's no single, like, solidified shots of anything. Everything is constantly in motion, which adds a lot more just speed to everything. So reading through this, I, like, read through each page almost twice because I was flying through them, but I realized I should maybe pay attention to some details. It's a fantastic book. I think this will be a really good collected read for anyone who's interested.
Okay, cool.
But yeah, so let's move on to our comic picks for this week. Tia, what's your comic pick for this week?
Well, I was going to recommend Black Widow, but since everyone's recommending Black Widow, I'm going to take the opportunity to plug my girl, Bobby Morse. Mockingbird number one is happening. This is not a drill. Pick it up. Basically, she is a very coveted spy, right? And she is being dosed with super soldier serum and all that good stuff, and they're kind of monitoring her, the like medical people, and all this weird stuff is happening, and she's trying to figure out like what the hell is going on. And it just looks incredibly funny and cool, and I'm hoping for some like ridiculous ex-husband Hawkeye action at some point. Basically, she appeared and they did like a 50th anniversary of S.H.I.E.L.D. They did all these specials and there was a Mockingbird one and it was so funny and so good. She's such a great character and I hope that she gets more of a following now that she's on the show on TV and hopefully people will pick up this book and realize how awesome she is.
Yeah, are they doing a spinoff series with her?
I heard that. Or? Yeah, I've seen Adrian something with a P. What's her name?
From Friday Night Lights?
From Friday Night Lights. I'm
blanking on her name too, yeah.
I always want to say Padalecki, but that's Jared Padalecki.
Yeah, and I mean, it's hard to forget him in the first place. So.
Anyway, she's got legs for days, and she makes an awesome Bobby. So I'm excited for all of the Mockingbird stuff that's happening. So go out and Mockingbird it up.
Yeah. Well, this week, Paul and I picked the same book, because I think it's the only book on our pull list.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's Black Widow number one. Do you wanna talk about this a little bit?
Well, I can tell you why I'm excited about it, and there might be different reasons than you have, Mike. This is the reunion, I guess we could call it, between Mark Waid and Chris Samnee, whose amazing run on Daredevil I absolutely mm-hmm. loved. And much like Daredevil, Black Widow's a character that I know only tangentially. Like, I don't never read a ton of stuff about her or featuring her. So I'm excited to get a series that's solely focused on Black Widow, written by someone like Mark Waid, who I think has a really good way of just sort of cracking characters open and getting at what makes them unique and interesting. And, I mean, Chris Samnee, he's one of a kind. I love his artwork so much. I think he's going to be a perfect fit for a, you know, sort of espionage-based character. A lot of shadows, moody lighting and stuff. I think he's going to nail it.
Well, and Matt Wilson is coloring, so that's exactly. going to kick it up yeah. to 11 yeah. for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that creative team, like I said, that Daredevil run that they had, I loved unconditionally, almost to a point where when I tried to read different Daredevil comics, they completely did not work for me. I made it through three issues of the new Daredevil. I was like, nope, this isn't doing it for me. So, oh, well, I'm just excited to see that team back and on a regular book like this, so I can't wait.
You should really pick up the Phil Noto, what is it, Nathan Edmondson Black Widow.
It's
so good.
Yeah.
So good.
Okay. Yeah. I can't say yeah enough.
I know.
That book was so good. And quite honestly, it's because of that book that I'm picking up this book. Like, if there can be a Black Widow story that is as good as that one, I would definitely leave it in the hands of Mark Waid to do that, because he is a fantastic writer. And like Paul said there, Chris Samnee's run with him on Daredevil was great. I read, I think, the first 10 or 12 issues of that, and I absolutely loved it. So I'm absolutely, totally looking forward to this new book. Black Widow is one of my favorite like Marvel characters right now, and it's because of that Phil Noto run, or the Nathan Edmondson and Phil Noto run, that I am so totally excited for her to have another book. Like, I was like heartbroken that the last series ended, and I'm glad that she's getting another book, because I need Black Widow in my life. Like, I love this character to death. So this is going to be a fun run. And if you're not reading it, that's a poor choice that you've made by not reading this book.
I agree.
Quite honestly, I can't see how they could screw this up. Like, this is a killer team. Yeah. They've got a great character to work with. Like, there's no way they can mess this up.
Well, I can think of a way they could mess it up. Oh. Because it's kind of a sausage fest on that creative team. And, you know... granted, they are all people who I trust not to be horrible to their woman characters, so I'm not saying that people have to write only within their identity, but I do wonder why they didn't bring any women, because there are plenty of creative women out there who would do a great job on a Black Widow book, and so I just am hoping that it is never something that I need to make an angry Tumblr post about.
I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt. Me too.
I trust this team. There are, you know, but sometimes you just wonder what's going on.
Just a little worry in the back of your head. I get that.
Yeah,
Marvel's website has all the wrong information about this book. I was trying to see who's like writing it and everything, and they have like Nick Spencer and Jesus Saez, I think.
What?
This is totally wrong. So, anyways, we are... You know, we're going to take a quick break because I'm very confused by the internet. And when we come back, we're going to talk about your comic book collection storage, which is something that I know we've talked about before on the show. But Tia having a very extensive history or background in art and, I guess, collection storage is going to lecture us about how we're doing everything wrong as comic book collectors.
Why do you hate your comics?
That's going to be the title of the show. Why do you hate your comics? So we'll be back in just a second. So this week, as I said before the break, we are going to talk about comic book collecting, and specifically comic book collecting storage. So as you know, as you buy your comics, if you're someone like me, you bag and board your books, and then you put them in a long box or a short box, and then they sit in the corner of your house, and you can look at them, and you could say, ah, wow, look at that collection that I have. And then if you want, you know, you can open up your boxes and pull your comics out and sort them and go through them, and you know, they're all protected, and it's great, right? So Tia has some, basically, she has a big, like, 9-point presentation that she wants to go through with us to talk to us about how actually what the things that I'm doing with my comic books and maybe Paul's doing with his comic books are actually not good for the books, not good for long-term storage. So like I said, I get my books every week, I bag and board them, which seems to be like the standard practice for a lot of people. And Paul, I don't remember, how do you when you get your books, what happens after you finish reading them in floppy form?
Well, they get thrown into a pile with other books that I've finished, and then that turns into another pile, and then that turns into another pile, and then the piles end up like on my desk. So then I, you know, if I have to use my laptop, there's a pile of books on top of my laptop, so I have to move that pile to the bed and then open up my laptop. When I reach a point where there's too many piles, then I bag them. And then I put them in long boxes. So that's my method.
Right, okay, but you don't board them. You just bag them and put them in.
Just bag them and put them in my. Okay. I have long boxes that are. Oh about my god! To burst.
You just put them in a long box, but no board.
No. Yeah.
Why don't you just set them on fire?
That's a really good question. It would save me a lot of time.
Yeah,
I live. Yeah. So I mean, I should preface this by saying I live in a shoebox, basically. So I have no space to store any of this stuff. That's why it becomes an issue. So I have to reaching a point where I have to decide: do I move to a bigger apartment, or do I just start selling stuff? You know. So
that seems like,
and both are equally
like
viable.
An Onion news article title: like man buys new apartment for larger comic book collection storage.
The best part about this is that me and Mike live in New York.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
And you're the one who needs a bigger apartment for your comics.
Well, this is a pretty fortuitous discussion, Mike, because I reached a point where, like I mentioned, the long boxes I have are in danger of bursting. So I bought a brand new one, and I'm thinking of new ways of organizing my collection. Right now, I more or less have them divided by publisher.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have a book for box for DC. I have a separate box for New 52. That's a whole other issue. I have one long box that's just Batman that is literally about to burst at the seams. And then I have my Marvel box, which I've labeled the house that Jack built, of course. and then
oh, I'm so happy about that. Okay, I'm sorry.
You know, so that's what I mean. So I've always had them divided by publisher, and I'm thinking maybe I could change that, although that feels like a bridge too far for me. I don't know if I'm ready for that level of commitment to change in my life. So I'm open to suggestions in that regard.
Gotcha. Okay, so this is a two-pronged discussion today: comic book storage and comic book organization.
Sure.
I hope you are ready, listener. This is going to be deep.
But I mean, so obviously, I think, you know, Tia, you are probably reacting with abject horror, given my description of the state of my collection, correct?
A little bit, yes.
Okay.
I'm going to preface this by saying, in general, most people have comic collections that are not actually worth a lot of money. And really, if you think about, like, you know, preserving them for posterity, someone is doing that somewhere to the highest possible degree of archival attention. So when I'm talking about here, I'm going to explain what that high level of attention would be, but that's kind of like level 11. For you, you can decide what scale works for you, keeping in mind that A, they're not the Declaration of Independence, right? Like, Nick Cage is not going to come steal your comics, and you're probably not going to ever sell them for millions of dollars, and they're not going to be the last copy of that issue on Earth. So what you're really thinking about here is preserving them for your own sentimental value, basically.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think on the last time we actually talked about this on the show, we kind of came to that same conclusion of we aren't necessarily preserving a lot of these comics for you know, to sell them back at a great auction, or, you know, when we have an estate sale and we're all 95, you know, they're going to go, oh my gosh, grandpa's comic book collection, and they're going to go apeshit, you know. It's mostly about preserving the memory and saying, look at this piece of artwork that I enjoyed, or this story that, like, really meant something to me, you know. So I just want to preface it with that we totally absolutely do understand that.
Yes. But, you know, some people, whenever I have this conversation with people, they inevitably ask, well, what would the highest degree of care be for these objects?
Yeah.
And before I was working in comics, I worked in art museums with extensive print collections and special archival collections where I both was researching, so I would handle these old manuscripts and letters and works on paper all the time, and I would also work with them as a curator putting together an exhibition of them, so I'm aware of best practices for storage, for handling, and also for display of works on paper, and specifically illustration-type works on paper. So a lot of what I have done in the past professionally in the museum world, when I came into comics and I see people shoving these works on paper into plastic, I'm just like, what are you doing? And then you store them upright? Like, why?
So did you actually work with any comic books? I'm genuinely curious if you happen to handle any old editions of, you know, Uncanny X-Men or Detective Comics or something like that.
No, I wish I did. That would be cool. These were more from the early 20th century, and these were illustrations for books, so they were not superhero comics, but they were some of them were mass produced, and some of them were partially mass produced and then hand colored, and there were sketches and a variety of print mediums and techniques. So I'll talk a little bit about what you can do for your comics. I'll also throw in what you can do for your sketches or any commissioned pieces that you have, because whenever I see someone proudly showing me a photograph of their commissioned sketch, you know, they've hung on their wall, I'm like, okay, well, that's going to fade in 3 months and just be ugly. So don't listen. It's fine. Don't listen to me. But never fear. We're here to help.
Yes, I'm so happy. I'm actually very excited about this, because I've always wanted to get, you know, like what you just said, like a very nice commission done by some artist. And I mean, I have a couple of, like, a sketchbook, like they're in a book, and, you know, so it's maybe some sort of preservation in a way. But it'd be, if I wanted to hang it on the wall, like, what would be the best practice? So that's really interesting. Let's get to it.
So first of all of these artist alleys, they have that booth where you can buy the plastic thingies to stick them in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Don't do it.
Really?
Do not do it. Yeah, because those things create mad static electricity, and depending on what the artist used to make the sketch, it's actually going to pull the pigment or the pencil or the whatever off the paper onto the plastic.
Huh.
You don't want that.
No.
Also,
this is,
yeah,
static electricity. It's so funny that they sell that at the, yeah, that they sell those at cons, though.
It's true. And even materials like polyethylene or mylar, which in some ways are used, and I'll talk about that in a second, for commissioned works that you've gotten that are not, like, printed material, you just don't do it. If you really want to take good care of them, get a folder of archival paper, like cardboard paper, that is mm-hmm. cut to the size, and you want to put a piece of glassine or archival tissue over the image to transport them.
Okay.
And then when you're ready to hang them up, it's a really smart idea to spend a little extra money on UV plexi when you have them framed. And you also want to make sure that whatever they're being matted with is acid-free, and that behind that acid-free mat is some kind of moisture barrier, because moisture is also bad for your works on paper. And a lot of times if you see older works on paper and it has these, like, weird little dots on it, we call that foxing. And, you know, that's just not what you want on your comics. And you don't want your sketches to get moldy, and all of that is bad. But the worst thing that you can do for your commissions is hang them in the light, because light damage is irreversible, and it happens every second that they're in the light.
So So when you say hang them in light, do you mean like sunlight, or even like would a like lamplight be problematic?
Even direct lamplight is not great. You don't want to hang them like where they're directly being lit. And the cool, the cool thing is that you can download on your smartphone any number of light meter apps, and you can actually like hold your phone up on the place on the wall that you want to hang your work, and it'll tell you how much light it gets. And you want museum standard is I think under 50 lux, so you can actually, you know, just sort of walk around and check out different places on your wall and pick the safest place for them. And finally, you need to rotate them every 3 months.
Is it, what's the reason for rotating them?
Well, you need to let them rest. You need to take them down off the wall so that they're not up constantly getting all of that light damage.
Okay. It's not a matter of like hanging the art, like you're not worried about gravity or anything, like pulling the paper down or something.
If they're matted properly, then they're fine in that respect. But it's just mainly that you want to reduce the exposure to the light, because like I said, it's irreversible and it happens every second that they're out exposed to the light.
So if you're storing them long, so say you take it off the wall and you're like, okay, I put it up for my 3 months, I'm gonna let it rest for another 3 months. What's the best type of environment to let something like that rest, whether it's a comic book or you know, a commission or something like that? What's the best way to store it, I guess?
If it's framed properly, it's pretty safe in the frame, and you just want to make sure that it's in a sort of cool, dry environment, not too humid and not too hot or cold. Just basically what would be comfortable for a person is pretty comfortable for a work on paper.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and make sure that you store it away. Like, don't put your collections in the attic or in the garage or in the basement. There's a lot of bad stuff that could happen to them there. You know, anything from bugs to flood to dirt. You're begging for trouble. So just keep them in the same environment you would keep yourself.
Gotcha. So then if we're trying to say I have like a copy of X-Men number one from way back, and I'm trying to, you know, keep that comic book, you know, have it in like pristine form, it's CGC graded, and I want to make sure to keep that book. I want it to be, you know, alive for generations beyond me. You know, how do I take care of a book like that?
Well, the problem with comics is that they themselves are not printed with archival materials.
Right.
So it's all well and good to put them in, you know, polyethylene bags or Mylar bags. They're fine in certain respects, and they're really easy to find. They're chemically stable. You know, they are waterproof, and so those are good. But like I said before, they can build up a lot of static electricity, so they could attract a lot of dirt and junk to them. And also, they don't really breathe. And so you're kind of just stewing your comic in its own acids, which is a problem. And you can get archival acid-free boards, but since the comic, and you should, if you're going to bag a board, you should use the acid-free boards. But if you have this really important comic that you want to preserve, first thing you should do is take out the staples.
Really?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But the staples hold the comic book together, Tia.
Well, staples are really bad for paper, and I don't know if they use stainless steel staples. I would assume that they do, but they still can put stress on the paper. And it just, if, like I said, this is like, you know, top level 11 museum best practice. They would take out the staples.
Okay.
And then they would put glassine paper between every page of the comic, because like I said, the paper itself and possibly even the inks are acidic, and they're oxidizing every second, and so you don't want them to touch each other, because they, you know, you want them on a clean surface.
Right.
And then you want to get our either folders or four flap binders that have their creases folded with to the exact width of what you're going to put inside, so that it doesn't stress it out. And from there, you can either put it in a solander box, again, made of acid-free materials, or if you're going to store the folder in some kind of like document box or even hanging files, that's fine. But if you're going to store your comic upright, it needs to be spine down. Spine down. Has to be spine down.
Really?
It just, yeah, because... If it's upright, well, if it's upright in the folder, then the gravity is going to be stressing it, and it's going to be kind of lopsided. Personally, I think it's best to store them flat in the solander boxes, but no more than, I would say, 5, and no more than 50 pages, because you don't want them to squish against each other either. So basically what you're just trying to do is you're trying to stress the paper out as little as possible.
Right.
And this is also why museum best practice is that you no longer wear gloves when you handle works on paper. I know you guys were talking about really? That a few weeks ago because somebody's fingers were bleeding.
Yeah.
But yeah, because you can't feel the paper, so you can't tell if you're stressing it out, and there's tiny little fibers in the cotton gloves that can damage the paper, so it's best to just use clean hands.
Oh, man. This is going to blow Nick's mind when he hears this.
I also recommend if you're eating something like popcorn or whatever, use chopsticks while you read your comics and eat food at the same time so you don't mess up your fingers.
Sure.
Okay. Chopsticks. That's, I would love to see like the person who does this, you know, and like they're trying to preserve their choice comics and they're reading them, eating popcorn with chopsticks.
That would be me and my old roommate.
Oh, really?
Wow.
So yeah, I mean, the problem with paper is that it's acidic and oxygen causes it to basically like decompose. And these problems are hastened by light exposure. The ink can also be degrading to the paper. I tried to look at a few of my comics to see what kind of paper they used, and I looked around the internet, but I couldn't find if it was archival. I do know that a few years ago, booksellers made a promise to print all first editions on acid-free paper, so it may not be as dire as we all think.
I see. Well, yeah, this is so much more than I thought to try to keep a comic book. Like, it's so bizarre then, because, you know... The long boxes have become the standard.
I know.
You know, for storing your books. And it's so funny because you'd think then that they would design those boxes to be horizontal or you know, so that you could lay your books down by the spine. But I guess, I don't know, there's like a height discrepancy among books, and I don't know how you would like create a box that could contain everything. So that's super crazy to me.
You should definitely try to store comics together that are similarly sized. Meaning, if you have a folder and you're going to put 5 comics in it, you don't want them to be all different sizes, because the places where there's overlap will get stressed out by the smaller comic pressed against it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. And again, this is like if you were the Museum of Comics, you know?
Yeah.
I don't want to be like super alarming here, but there are cases where museum best practice is to put a work on paper in polyurethane or some similar material. They call it encapsulation, and they try not to cover it on all sides if they don't have to, but especially for documents that get handled a lot, if they're in bad condition, it's the lesser of the evils for them to be encapsulated. But they often will treat them first so that the acid is somewhat mitigated. I don't think that treating your comic books for acid is something that you need to worry about necessarily.
Yeah.
But if you've got X-Men number 1 or something that's really important, I would say, especially if you have more than one, it might be worth your while to look into having some of these storage materials made for you. They're not terribly expensive. And you know, if you had one document box or one solander box that you could put, you know, 5 comics in that were just worth so much to you, that would probably be better than sticking them in a long box.
Gotcha.
That's... I mean, it's very interesting. I, you know, I got to say, I started reading comics right before the big speculation boom in the 90s.
Yeah.
So I remember all the, I mean, I remember this was such a big thing, like the CGC rating system, like that became such a thing. People were getting brand new comics, you know, boarded and bricked in that big plastic CGC. You know what I'm talking about? The comic?
Yeah. Yeah.
CGC. Yeah, yeah. And I thought that was the dumbest thing ever because my immediate response was, well, how are you going to read it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, that brings me to another really important point, which is all of these bags that are either self-adhesive or that people are taping shut. I mean, am I the only person who, whenever I take something in or out of a bag, I'm just like, is this the day that I'm going to get the cover stuck on the tape?
That's
just stop. Just stop using any adhesive. If you're going to bag and board your comics, which is fine. They'll be fine. But don't have any adhesive around it. You don't need to tape them shut because frankly, water damage is less of a problem than tearing it.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, there is that chance unless you're very careful with pulling your book out of the bag, you know, that's always a concern. I know that I've had that happen to far too many comics than I wish to admit.
Just stop taping them shut. Just let them breathe. And then you can let them breathe a little bit too, which would be nice.
Yeah, but like, if they have the tops and you can try to pull one out, then it pulls the top out of like four of them. And then your box is all messy and you're like, oh, how am I going to get into here? And then you run into the problem. And I've had this happen before when I had like 50 or 60 comics where I went to reach in and I accidentally reached into the Mylar bag or the polyurethane or poly whatever that is, the plastic bag. And I like reached into the comic and like pushed my hand against the cover of another book on accident. And I was like, no, like there was just a loud Darth Vader noise coming from the room that I was in.
Well, A, you shouldn't be storing them upright, so put them on their side with the spine down and you won't have that problem.
Okay.
And B, you shouldn't have them so crowded into a box. They shouldn't be that crowded. Now you don't want them to be like slumped over, and you should get a spacer for them so that they could stay upright but not be, you don't want, if you cram them all in, yeah, all sorts of bad things can happen.
Right.
So, I mean, Tia, I have to ask, is this how you store your comics? Are you this meticulous or do you have a different method that you use?
So, no, this is not how I store my comics, except because the next thing I'm going to tell you is comics cost like $4. So, if a comic is really that important to you that you want to preserve it forever, but you also still want to read it, but you buy two. Or maybe you buy one and you get a digital copy and you handle the digital, you handle your regular comic, your physical comic very little and you read the digital. I would also say, you know, my comic collection, like I said, it's more sentimental than monetary value. And I think that the only part of my collection that I would now is built up enough that I'm like, wow, I really want to take care of this, is I have every single Wicked and the Divine cover, every single one, every single variant. Sure. I even got the volume 3 trade variant cover that Tula Lote did and that they sold in 4 stores in Northern England. I have all of them.
Wow. And so that's the stuff that you're actually taking super, super good care of then.
Yes. This is the stuff that I'm like, you know, I think I am going to have some boxes and folders made for these because I would like these to be preserved, mostly because I only know of one other person who actually has the whole collection. And so I feel like having the whole collection together is a good reason to be like, well, maybe, you know, it's worthwhile to give it some special attention. But also it's just a book that means the world to me and I want to make sure that it's with me forever. So yeah. Again, I really don't think that you should run out and spend hundreds of dollars on a new comic book system of storage because thinking that you're going to like make $1 million selling your you know, Mockingbird number one at auction one day, that's just probably not going to happen. But if they mean something to you, it's probably, you know, it could be worth it.
That's very interesting because, you know, I mentioned earlier in the show that my favorite like comic book of all time is Grant Morrison's Doom Patrol, And I have a complete run of his Doom Patrol by Grant Morrison in single issues, but I bought them all out of like 50 cent and dollar bins. So they're all yellowed, they're dog-eared, and I kind of love them because of that.
Interesting. You know what I mean? Yeah.
They mean so much to me, and I've read them so many times that they're like, I've got like thumbprints on them, they're dog-eared, like I said, they're just kind of like tattered, and I think that, for me, shows my level of love for those books in the same way that preserving them for all eternity does.
I totally get that. Yeah. Because, you know, these are not precious sacred objects, and they're also not the only ones in existence. Like,
exactly.
Like I said, they're not the Declaration of Independence. These are your books that you read. Yeah. So, and if you were kind of torn between these two ideas, like I said, you could always just try to buy two or buy copies digitally to read if you really, really don't want to touch them.
Yeah. Alternatively, you could just, you know, do what Paul did and then have them all rebound into a giant hardback. That's also a thing that people do where they...
That's true.
Yeah, they've seen good
ones. You take
your
books. Yeah, and I'm actually really impressed with some of the like collections that I've seen done where they take all these single issues and they make them into a trade with the, you know, the old ads in them and everything. Just to say, like, here is the old experience, but they are now rebound in a way that I can probably take care of a little bit better. So
definitely.
I think there's definitely more than one way to, you know, preserve this type of stuff. And it's not, you know, I think the way that you've described tea is probably probably best for, you know, absolute perfection, you know, keeping and potentially, you know, reselling. But, yeah. You know, for something like what you have, Paul, like I think, you know, having them rebound into a hardcover or just, you know, keeping it like you have, it totally works as well. So long as, you know, you're keeping them in a safe enough space where they're not going to get spilled on or, you know, water damage or anything like that. So,
yeah,
this
it's way easier to keep hardcover books safe than it is to keep floppy single issues safe, definitely.
Yeah. So, you know, this was an exhaustive explanation of how to store comics properly, and it was very interesting. And in my mind, my sort of reaction is to say, well, it's so funny that the majority of comic book history, they were designed to be purely disposable, cheap entertainment.
It's true.
It's only now that we're sort of like thinking about them in this archival way. But returning to you know, the thing I proposed at the beginning of this conversation, Mike, why don't you store your books divided by publisher?
Oh, well, okay.
That drives me nuts. I did not
realize how many people actually did that until very recently. And the more and more people I talk to about it, they have their own set of organization like that. And I store mine alphabetically simply because I used to have such a big collection. You know, I had like 10 long boxes of comics, and to separate them out and have uneven boxes and stuff like that just made my skin crawl. I hate having a short long box, you know, like a box that you have to put like a shoebox in to just prop up all the books or something. And I know a shoebox isn't a good way to keep your books standing up.
Or you could just not tell me that. Just let them all get, to do it my method, and just let them all get bent and just forget about it.
My thought was I just... You know, my X-Men are always going to be at the back, and, you know, my Amazing Spider-Man are always going to be at the front. Two Marvel books, I guess. But at least I'll know, like, it goes Amazing Spider-Man, then Batman, then Dark, you know, or, I don't know, a D book. But still, like, I could go through, and I know where everything is sorted alphabetically. Daredevil. Okay, yeah, there we go. Alphabetical to me just makes a lot of sense. It does get really tedious when it comes down to, like, there was an Age of X book that came out, and it was like an X-Men book, but it's technically starts with an A, so I sorted it by A. And then I was trying to figure out, well, crossover events, like, do you order them by the reading order? Do you put them in the, like, actual comic book order? So, like, when X-Factor crossed over with X-Men, should I put those side by side, or should they actually be next to each other so that if I ever pulled them out to read? And then in my head, I was like, well, I'll just remember. And, of course, the one time I went to go lend someone a bunch of crossover books, I was like, wait, what other four books were in this crossover? It was awful. But that's why you should just not read the X-Men. Only let me read the X-Men. It's okay. I'll figure it all out. But I don't know. The alphabetical just always seemed like the right way. That's the same way I order all of my, you know, trades. It's the same way I order all of my, you know, prose novels. When I used to have an extensive CD collection back when I was in high school, and that's how I ordered all of those. But then again, I don't know how you would reorder CDs. Maybe by label, but that would just be weird. But then, and then we also talked about the, what did you call it before the show, Tia, called the high fidelity ordering.
Yeah, high fidelity ordering.
Right, right.
And that's ordering by when, yeah, biographical. So, and Nick actually sorts his books like that. He said that he sorts them by the date, like when he purchases them. To me, that is absolute chaos.
No,
like,
it isn't.
How do you, no, how do you ever find anything?
Because I just know that, like, okay. I just know.
Yeah. I think that would work. That would work for me for, like, the most recent 4 weeks worth of books. And then after that, I would go, I have no idea where to find that issue of Cable. I'm exactly. sorry. I bought it 6 years ago.
But that, but you know what, though? The night, I mean, I have to search for stuff sometimes, too. But it's like, you, then you you get to fall into the nostalgia rabbit hole where you're, like, looking for, but then you find this other stuff that maybe you didn't even know that you still had. You hadn't thought about it in six years, you know? So it's a way that, like, keeps you, I think, acquainted with your comic book collection, if, especially if it's really unwieldy, because it forces you to really, like, look through it a lot.
Yeah. And I'm sure that it's probably less of a burden to actually put new books in. Alphabetical is awful simply because it's like, oh, I got a new, you know, I got six issues of Fight Club that I need to port somewhere. And oh, man, I have to, that means I have to move six issues out of this long box. And then it cascades down to the next three boxes.
Absolutely.
Maybe I should reevaluate my sorting. But now it's already in alphabetical ordering. So what do I do? Like, then I have to take them all out and resort them by publisher. And then I have to figure all that out. It's too much work. I might as well just burn all my comics. I think that's the answer now.
I think that's the conclusion we've come to, is that we all hate comic books.
This has been the I Read Comic Books podcast, where we hate everything. No.
That's... Yeah, no, you know, what might be really fun is if you come up with a theme for each of your long boxes, and then once it's full, you have to, like, you know, then it's done, and you have to just think more creatively about what kind of theme your book that you need to file away, like, how does it fit into these other, that would be chaos, I mean, too, but it would be fun.
I'm actually kind of already doing that. I just A through F, that's a theme, and then, you know, G through M is a theme. That could work, though. I'm actually really interested to see if you've made it this far in the podcast. Send us a tweet or email us, actually, about your comic book collection, if you have one. If you have, like, a physical like long box or short boxes or something, how do you sort your comics? Because I think there isn't a standard way. So if you have something that's different than what we said, or if even something the same, we'd love to hear about it.
Or if you have any questions about sourcing archival materials or thinking of different ways that are more best practices friendly to store your comics, and you have questions, you can tweet and I'll try and put you in the right direction.
Yeah, so check the show notes. We actually have a new Twitter account and email account that you can send us stuff to. So please reach out to us. That'd be fantastic.
Yeah, if you want to admonish me for my sloppy collecting, that's fine. I need it. I need to be, scolded for that. So
I'm literally looking at a random pile of comics on my coffee table right now. So I'm living in a decidedly glass house.
Yeah. Same here. I have a pile of comics sitting next to me, and it's menacing. It's menacing.
How do you organize and store your comics? As Mike mentioned, we have new places to contact us, so you can email us your organizational preferences at the podcast's new email address, ircb@destroythesaib.org. Also, feel free to follow our new Twitter account for the show, at ircbpodcast. We're still hanging out on Tumblr, at destroythesaiborg, and you can post material and questions over at our subreddit at ireadcomicbooks.reddit.com. Our host and producer is Mike Rappin, and the show is edited by myself, Xander Riggs. This week's music was brought to you by Poldor and Infinity Shred. You can find Poldor on Bandcamp at poldor.bandcamp.com, where you can pre-order the new album that releases on the 1st of April. And you can find more of the magnanimous Infinity Shred at infinityshred.bandcamp.com. Podcast high fives to our Podern family listeners. No matter what type of podcast you're looking for, you can find it, or something close to it, on Twitter via the hashtag PodernFamily. Finally, if you like the show, tell someone about it. rate us online, or write to us. We'd love to hear your thoughts on comics, and we hope your comics are good to you.
So if I'm already like a little tired from today, it's because I woke up at 10:30 this morning and did an interview with Xander for another podcast about our podcast. Okay. So a friend of mine does a podcast called Podcast Fiend, and it's basically a podcast about podcasts, which apparently isn't the most original idea in the world, but the first like 3 or 4 episodes he's done have been really, really good, mm-hmm. and I'm super excited for us to be on it. So he interviewed Xander and I about it this morning. So
cool.
I've already talked a bunch today into a microphone.
Yo, dog, I heard you like podcasts, so I put a podcast in your podcast so you can podcast your podcast.
Pretty much. That's the idea.
I hope you have some lemon tea.
Yeah, I've been drinking energy drinks nonstop since then.
Michael
so,
Bartholomew Rappin, no.
Oh, good. Someone else does the middle name thing. That's hilarious. Xander does that to me.
What's his middle name for you?
It changes every time. Mm. But Bartholomew, I'm pretty sure, has been in there. Rutherford was a big one for a while, actually. Michael Rutherford Rappin.
That just sounds like some D-bag you would meet at a country club.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. sorry, that just tickled me.